streets don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your hosts, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
Good evening, and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back radio show. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, The Streets Don't Love You Back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes. As we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight, so stay tuned in to the hottest radio show worldwide.
We're very honored tonight to have a guest, Mr. Tony Napoli, join us, and he's going to tell his story. Mr. Napoli is the son of one of the most powerful and respected organized crime leaders of the modern era. His father was a mob kingpin who ruled over the largest gambling empire in America for almost 40 years. Tony grew up in Brooklyn. Had a checkered life as a soldier, a boxer, an enforcer, a casino boss, a fugitive, and a hustler. Finally, after a brutal attack against a young man who sexually abused his daughter, Tony was sentenced to the VA hospital and did a little bit of recovery. Tony's message tonight is more of one of being sobriety, I should say, and we'll hear his story tonight. It's going to be an awesome, awesome interview, and we look forward to his important message. We'd like to welcome all of our fans in the chat room and those listening on the line. We will take some callers here in just a little bit. Before we get started, let me go ahead and welcome Boyd to the show.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for tuning in to the show every Wednesday night. And like the missus said, we have an awesome show tonight with Mr. Tony Knapp, and he's here to tell his message. And we're honored to have him here. And without further ado, we would ask Mr. Tony to formally introduce himself, and let's get this party started.
Hello, Lucinda. Hi, Rob. Okay, my name is Tony Napoli. They call me Tony Knapp. I'm also called TN, nicknames given to me by the street guys as well as the FBI. And I'm here to talk about my story, My Father, My Don, my autobiography that I published, it'll be 3 years ago, September. And I self-published it. And I've had movie deals and TV deals I've turned down because they wanted to change the characters and do creative writing, and I refused to do so because my story is a true story, and it is not based on a true story. It is a true story. So I've turned down money. Money is not the main object, although money helps pay some of the expenses. However, I want my story to be told as is, if possible. And if it doesn't go to a film or TV, I'm satisfied with the book. And my estate, my wife and children, will publish more and reprint more and keep it the same as it is. And not to sell it out to anyone unless they properly examine the person, that they won't do too much creativity. And I want also the message to be brought to the public about sobriety being stronger, a stronger force than the oath taken by members of organized crime and the oath taken by members of street gangs as well. This sobriety is a better way of life, I find that to be. Now I'm open for questions, and here I am, Rob and Lucinda. How are you?
Oh, we're great, Mr. Knapp, and I'll let the missus start off with the questionnaire, you know?
Okay.
Well, you know, your book is awesome, and I haven't quite finished it yet, but it's just amazing to hear the truth and the things that that you talk about, because you do say the truth in there. And, you know, the opening chapter of your book tells the story of what happened to the young man who abused your daughter. And,
yes.
You know, you hear a lot of men talk a lot of talk about what they would do if somebody did something to their daughter, and a lot of them don't follow through on it. You did.
Well, you have to remember.
He kept his hands to himself.
I had alcohol in me, too, for a good many years, and that was the last violent act I ever committed. And because of that act, my daughter allowed me to talk about it because she says that's when you found sobriety, because when you got arrested and you were sentenced to the VA hospital for treatment for 3.5 years was my sentence of attempted murder. Although the punk, he got away with 1 year's probation. He's alive, but he'll never reproduce another monster like himself. I made sure of that. So that's what happened there, yes. And, of course, in my family tradition, from grandfather to father to son, I'm a third generation in this country of the Napoli family, and was that the children come to the father before they go to the cops. And then I make that decision. And that's what my daughter did. But she did go to the doctors. And she, after a while, she eventually went and told her story to the local authorities to get the boy arrested, because I was the one who was arrested. He wasn't until my daughter filed papers. I was the one who was arrested. He was never arrested for the rape because they didn't have enough evidence, you know. Well, actually, it wasn't a rape. It was a sexual assault, and it was in Queensborough Community College, a local college in Queens that she was going to, and the security guards were sleeping in their room as usual, and in the hallways, they were supposed to be patrolling the hallways, and my daughter, in between classes, went to the girls' room, and she was being stalked by this individual for 2 weeks. She felt it. She felt the vibes, and he grabbed her by the girls' room, pushed her in, and threw her on the floor and whatnot. Well, thank God, two other girls were coming to the girls' room as well, and he ran away before he could complete his task. But that was enough to tell me that he'll be back. So when my daughter... when I got all the information from my oldest daughter, who told me what happened to her sister, then I was able to perform my act by teaching them a lesson. And I went in a classroom with 21 students. I pushed them through the door during 9 o'clock in the morning was the first class. And I grabbed him and threw him through the door. He fell on the floor, and I dissected him while they were dissecting a frog. Of course, it was a biology class.
Wow. So they jumped off Mr. Knapp while they was dissecting their thing. You was handling your business at the same time, which,
correct.
You know, I have to give you big ups on that, because your daughter, you know, is your queen. You know what I mean? That is, you know, a man's everything when it comes to their daughter. Men love their sons, but that daughter, I think it's just something different when it comes to putting your hand on your daughter. Can you elaborate on that, Mr. Knapp?
Yes. Well, I took the law into my own hands, but that's before I found sobriety. And what happened was I wanted to protect, defend my daughter's honor, and I would give up my life, and I proved I would if I had to do a lifetime in jail if that punk died. He was hemorrhaging to death, and the FBI agents who eventually picked me up at the 111th precinct, where I was picked up from the school and locked up at on attempted murder charges, the FBI, four strong, came to the precinct and set up a private room for conversation, trying to make a deal with me. That I wouldn't go to jail if that boy died in the hospital. They said that they would send me to Minnesota if I would join their team called Team America. And I told them, listen, I'm an American. I defended this country in Strategic Air Command under General Curtis LeMay, the United States Air Force. I said, you want to call Team America with those stool pigeons on Team America? Well, that's your prerogative, but I'll never join that because I have nothing to say. And if I have anything to say, it would be to the public, not in a court of law, that I would give anybody up that would have to go to jail. If I give anybody up to be myself, I'll be my own defendant, my own witness, because I have no other witnesses in my favor over that incident. And that's all I got to say, I told him. And I'll never forget the FBI agent's name was James Stewart. I remember because there was an actor by the name of James Stewart, Jimmy Stewart. And he gave me his business card if I ever want to talk to him. Of course, I threw it away. I didn't bother with it. And then I was finally booked on the Organized Crime Task Force because they couldn't book me at the regular cops at 111 Precinct because I was registered. They had me listed as an organized crime person. And I have to be questioned because when people like myself get involved in an incident, then the Organized Crime Bureau comes after you to make a deal with you, and you don't have to do time, even if you robbed a bank or if you killed somebody. If they think you have enough information to put someone else away, like Sammy the Bull did with John, my friend John Getty. Well, anyway, I was sentenced after all that time. I was sentenced for 3.5 years at the VA hospital, Fort Hamilton, Brooklyn. I served my time there, and I stayed an extra year and a half. I stayed for 5 years because I became a patient counselor to help in the sobriety program for recovering alcoholics. And till today, I'm 17 years, July 11th, in sobriety. And I also help indigent fighters who can't fight anymore and have injuries and don't have much money. I belong to Ring 8, an organization of over 330 of us in the New York area that help raise funds for indigent fighters who need our help for medication. I'm busy all the time as a volunteer with the VA hospitals for veterans who, disabled veterans who fight for their compensation for service-connected injuries, and I no fee I charge. With my knowledge, I'm able to help them get increases on their service-connected injuries up to 100%. I've done for over 300 veterans now, and most of them are getting their checks, and I get beautiful letters, and I keep staying on it. The only way I stay in sobriety is because I stay active voluntarily doing something with no fee, because money does not mix with sobriety, just enough money to stay above water. And that's what I do today. And I go on book tours and I pay my own expenses to bring my message forward. I just got back from Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, Columbus, Missouri. I was also in Strasburg, Pennsylvania. I was in Vegas, Nevada. The first time in 38 years, the mayor, Oscar Goodman, invited me there for a book signing, and I did it out there. And I had my statute of limitations not to ever come to Nevada again back in 1974. Statute of limitations ran out, and the new mayor, Oscar Goodman, invited me there, and he wanted me to give him some memorabilia of my father for the Vegas and Mob Museum that he put together in downtown Vegas. It used to be the old post office. And he has my father's hat and tie and a few of my books autographed in the museum. He wanted to show the public that the good and the bad with the mob life, and that there was less crime in Vegas when the mob guys were there controlling the casinos and kept a lot of garbage out. Now, yes, there's pros and cons about that. Who is garbage? Who is this? Who is that? Well, the mayor feels as though when men prove that there's less crime and take care of their own crime and settle it and defends the public the way the boys did in Vegas by no robberies. There was hardly any robberies at all in those days, back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So anyway, I did my book signing out there, and they invited me back again. But however, my health doesn't allow me to travel too often. So here I am talking on these radio on the radio show with Rob and Lucinda. What else?
My man. And let me ask you this here, Mr. Knapp. When you was in Vegas, what bars you away from Las Vegas at that time?
When I was in Vegas, what was that? I didn't get that.
why did they bar you out of Las Vegas?
What happened was I was a casino boss at Caesar's Palace. I started at the Sands, and then we went from the Sands in 1958 to Caesar's Palace with mob control money from the East Coast mob here in New York. And I followed the money, and I had the knowledge of casino operation and how to operate and also deal. I dealt every game, craps, blackjack, baccarat, roulette, etc. And I, because my father was the type of guy, he said, you're going to do something, learn the game. If you're going to be in a dry cleaning business, learn how to be a spotter cleaner so you could advise others in the cleaning business that worked for you. He said, always let your employees know that you too could jump in and work and do what they're doing if you have to. That, not that you stand by. So anyway, I was a boss there, and then what happened was they were skimming off the top and had to get money back to the boys, and the only way to do it without paying income tax or free of taxes is to, before the money gets into the counting room, to get it at the tables and from the cashier. And to go into that would be a little schooling I'd have to give you, and I don't want the people to be bored with that, but they can learn if they read my book, My Father, My Don, and it explains that particular situation of how that operation works and how I was able to skim off the top of the boys and also take care of myself too, you know, money-wise, in those days. Now, remember, that's before sobriety. And I was a selfish individual, and I also took care of myself. I made sure I got a good share. I elected that to be for me, a certain share, a certain amount of money, you know. So anyway, I got indicted. Well, actually, what happened was, before the indictment, I got subpoenaed, and I spoke to the agents, and I said, listen, I'll get out of this state. I'll never come back here again. I don't want a trial. I don't want to draw anybody in here as witnesses. I'll just leave. And they said, go, good, get on your way and get out of here. Get the hell out of here and go back to Brooklyn, New York. And I did, and they never bothered with the case anymore, you know. And that's what happened. So when I got back, the boys all celebrated, and they wished me luck. And when I got back, I created and put together the first Las Vegas Nights in the different communities for the Jewish rabbis, for Catholic churches, and I showed them how to make money and raise funds legally if they got, as long as they had the permit to run like lotto, like they do with bingo games, and the consumer affairs would allow it as long as it was a non-profit making organization. And I showed them how to use gambling in place of bingo, you know. And bingo is also a form of gambling, yes. However, and I introduced that, and then I had to stop because I got subpoenaed. And all of my dealers were locked up, and the judge, on a Labor Day weekend, and all my equipment was confiscated, and the judge dismissed all charges anyway after 3 days because it was helping the churches to raise funds, and they were getting the money, and the only thing I wanted was my people to get paid. They weren't volunteers. They had other jobs. Most of them were school teachers and city workers. And I taught them how to deal the games. And they made extra money to help pay their mortgages and their rent. Just like my father in the number business in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, for over 40 years, he employed over 300 people. Actually, he employed over 300 families, and he had over 900 runners that picked up the number action form in the streets in the five boroughs. It blossomed into a business of $150 million a year. And he was able to keep people off welfare because of the fact that he started this back in the early 1940s, when it was right after the Second World War. and he created it. It was called the number business, the numbers racket. Dutch Schultz had the New York action, and my father had the Brooklyn action. And we would take the number out of the daily newspaper, and you would look at the last three digits of the total mutual handle bet at the racetrack each previous day. And whatever the last three digits is, was your number. And you get paid 500 to 1. And that's what he did, and he was called the king of the number business in
wow.
Triborough. But he also replaced Bugsy Siegel in 1949. Bugsy Siegel was hit in 47, and because of the Genovese family my father was associated with, and called the Rolls-Royce of all families. And that was the one Lucky Luciano put together in the beginning, before he got deported to Italy. And it was called the Genovese family because Lucky blessed Vito Genovese to take over the family back in the days of World War II and after World War II. So my father was appointed, and he had to get together with Meyer Lansky, and he helped build the Sands Hotel and Caesar's Palace and the Tropicana Hotel in Vegas, all places I was a floor boss or worked at as a boss. Also worked as a dealer at times to show the other dealers that I'm able to deal the game so they would respect me, with my father's philosophy. That when I talked to them, if they did something wrong at the table, they felt I knew what I was talking about. And but getting back to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, my father's neighborhood, we called it Jimmy Knapp's neighborhood. The people were, till today, there are those that are alive, but not the actual fathers and mothers or grandfathers and grandmothers of the people that actually worked for my father, but their relatives are alive, their nieces and nephews. And every time they see me, they kiss me and they remember the memories of my father, how the number of business helped their parents and grandparents pay their rent and keep their houses because times were bad. And it was considered a clean business because the state of New York is doing it for years. And that's just what my father did. The only thing is, he didn't have a license. And Judge Meschler, when he had a sentence of my father once to 7 years, give him the maximum sentence because he was promoting gambling without a license, the judge said, "Mr. Napoli, I apologize to you. You're doing nothing different than the state of New York is doing, but the only thing is you don't have a license, and I got to give you the maximum sentence." And he sentenced my father 7 years. Unusual that a judge apologizes to a defendant. And I have the newspaper articles I save on that, too, yeah. And it's in the book, too, by the way, yeah. My Father, My Don, and you can get that on my website as well, www.myfathermydon.com. Or you go to Google and find me. According to my youngest daughter, she said.
Right.
That's how I found you. I found you on Google.
Sounds good. We like that, Mr. Knapp.
Hey, Tony, go back and talk a little bit about your father. When he was a teenager, he left home. He was very strong-willed, wanted to be a man and make it on his own. And he did that.
When he met Al Capone.
Right.
When my father left his mother and father.
Right. He drove a load of alcohol from New York to Chicago to Al Capone. And
right, yeah. Well, what happened was my father was 14, 15 years old. In those days, you're 14, 15 years old, you went out to work. Forget about high school or college. He went through grammar school. As a matter of fact, there was about a half a dozen guys that he graduated from grammar school with that he carried on with him for the rest of his life until they died. They worked for him in the number business. And they went to grammar school with him. Well, anyway, in the interim, my father, now when he was about 18 and 19, he was driving the bootleg trucks from New York to Chicago for Frankie Yale. And Frankie Yale got hit in the head, and he got whacked out in 1928. and my father drove the trucks back and forth from New York to Chicago. And Frankie recommended my father as a tough guy as well as a man with brains. And when he got to Chicago, Al Capone gave my father an assignment to do. And accordingly, this is all according to the FBI records now. My father never spoke to me about this, and he never spoke to anybody in the family about this. He never brought his street business into the household. It was not like the Sopranos were. My father was real. He was unique. He would never talk his business at the table and never encouraged any of his children or relatives to follow his footsteps. No. He said, go to college. Do the opposite. That was my family. That is not similar to any of these TV shows you do. The reality is that my father schooled us to go to college, but if we went the wrong way, it wasn't his doings. It was our own doings behind the scenes. We were doing that on the side. Because I have the last name, and people always thought I knew the business and that I could get to my father for them when they needed help. And I used to use that. Well, anyway, my father had an assignment in Chicago for the assassination of Elliot Ness. And according to the FBI, they give the story that my father missed Elliot Ness, accordingly, rather than say my father, the Jimmy Knapp, alleged Jimmy Knapp, Napoli from Greenpoint, Brooklyn, was the assassin who missed Elliot Ness and hit his partner, who jumped on top of Elliot Ness in the front seat of a car when the alleged Jimmy Knapp, Napoli was firing at them. And he got locked up that night, and the only witness against him was an old man who was in protective custody. In those days, they kept him as the material witness overnight in the jail cell and locked him up in the jail cell to protect him. Well, the next morning, that old fellow had a shiv in him, and Rob knows what that means. It was a shiv that they made a spoon into a knife, the prisoners, and stuck right. It in the old fellow's chest. And whoever did that had to be one of the cons because the way it was done with a shiv, only the cons would make the shiv. The jailhouse guards, they didn't use a shiv. They had their own pistols. Well, anyway, they made it look like a con did it, but it was probably one of the jailhouse hacks, you know. And now that there was no evidence, no witnesses, they had to let the alleged Jimmy Knapp Napoli from Greenpoint, Brooklyn, they had to release him. There was no evidence. He was never tried. And that agent, the right-hand man of Elliot Ness, was killed, and they never solved that killing. And at that time, my father, however, went back to his mother and father because he left them. He was a prodigal son like I was to him and my mother, and so was my father a prodigal son. He went back to see his mother, who always went to church every morning, and he met his mother in church. And he spoke in Italian to her. It's in the book. I have it in Italian and translated into English, that particular segment of the book. And he kissed his mother, and he found out that his father was dying, so he didn't leave. He stayed with his mother and helped support her while before his father died. His father died in 1931, and I was born in 1935, and my father named me after his father. Well, anyway, in similarity, I too left my father when I got discharged from the United States Air Force honorably. And he told me what happened was I worked a crooked cop over in Union City, New Jersey, who tried to shake me down when my father gave me a nightclub when I got honorably discharged as a reward. And he gave me a nightclub in Union City, New Jersey to run, and it was mine, under my name, the liquor license, everything. And this here crooked cop, he was a captain of the police department at the time in Union City, New Jersey, and he tried to shake me down. I gave him a beating. And what happened was he was hospitalized. And then eventually he dropped the charges. Of course, my father got to him with money, I imagine. And my father told me, now get out of town. And it's in the book the way he explains to me, change your name, I'll locate you. I'll find you. Don't call me. And he never found me for 3 years and 2 months, and I changed my name to Tony Rio, and I became a fighter, and I worked in the Midway Carnival as a fighter, fighting spectators for $1 a round. And now, then I traveled on the boxcars with Siamese twins, the Lobster Man, the Lobster Woman, the Bearded Lady. I'll never forget one of these Siamese twins. They were attached at the hips, two women, and one wanted to make love to me. I said, "What are you, crazy? Your sisters are." So, but I was only interested in my bottle of whiskey anyway. I used to buy a pint of whiskey in those days, Dewey's. And I traveled that way as I was fighting. I was still drinking, and I never called home. And then finally, when I did, I found out my mother passed away of cancer. And, of course, it's in the book, and it was a tearful situation. And my father finally came to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he found me in the mountains. And he took me back to New York to see the family and say hello to everybody. And he said, "All is forgiven." And that's where I was at. And I was there. When my father passed away, I was there with him. But I was Tony Napoli again, not Tony Rio. So that's what happened with my father with the Al Capone situation, if it's true. And then with my situation, working a crooked cop over and changing my name and then him finding me was a similarity with two prodigal sons, father and son, to their families.
How old were you when you started drinking?
When I started drinking,
yeah,
I was 25. I was always in shape because I was a prize fighter and I was an amateur and also training fighters. From when I was 15 years old to 20, I boxed for 10 years, and I stopped drinking. Well, I started drinking 24, 25, and I drank until July 11th, 1994. That's 17 years ago, because that's how I know about my sobriety.
What made you start drinking at that age?
What made me start what?
Drinking alcohol. Do you remember?
Oh, I had my own bar. I didn't have to pay for it. And it was relaxing, and it was part of the environment. Everybody said, "Have a drink, have a drink, have a drink." And I was drinking. I was like 24 years old or so. Yes, 24, 25, 26, like that. And before that, I used to have a Valentine ale. It was like a beer, but it was an ale. When I was in training, I would have a Valentine ale because it wasn't considered malt beer, you know. And all the fighters, we would do that as a refreshing drink. Valentine ale we used to drink. It had alcohol in it, about 5%. But it was relaxing. But the heavy stuff started hitting me, like when I was 24, doers on the rocks, martinis, this and that, you know. And I drank until I was 60 years old when I had my last drink. After that incident with that punk, I never drank again.
Wow.
No. And I'm a counselor now, and I stay with it. And I do counseling on the phone. My phone is always open with a tape recorder. And if I'm not home, whoever needs me, they call me. It could be a veteran. It could be an ex-fighter. And it could be a recovering alcoholic. Who's in rehab, and they leave me a message, and I get back to all of them the next morning. I hit my phone one at a time with I know what their phone numbers are, and that's how I do. I stay continuously 24 hours a day on therapy, yes, for alcoholism.
It is a day to day thing, one day at a time. So can you talk a little bit about the recovery process and the importance for the family to get involved and what it takes to go through all that?
Yes. What happened? My family got involved with my recovery. Yes. What happened is called Al-Anon. At the VA hospital, Fort Hamilton, where I was sentenced, and I found sobriety there. I was sitting there 3.5 years, and I told you I stayed there for 5 years, a year and a half. I was the last year and a half I was a volunteer patient counselor because they're shorthanded, and I had a group session there. Well, anyway, My wife and my daughters, they joined Al-Anon in the beginning when I got there the first year, and they were there once a week for the first year to learn how to live with a recovering alcoholic. And they did that for the first year. And then my wife is in sobriety with me, but she never was an alcoholic. But she does that because of me. And I married to her to be 41 years ago, August 15th. And she stays in sobriety with me. And my children, they managed to, if they drink at all, they usually don't drink in front of me at all. But when they go out, they're young, you know. And I have three daughters with bachelor's degrees and two of them with master's degrees. And the other one, that would be the one who was sexually assaulted, has two master's degrees. She's a school teacher. She's a teacher's coach now, by the way. She teaches how to teach a class, and she was the one who was sexually assaulted, yes. She turned her life around, too, yes, I mean. And she, I don't know if she ever got over all that, but she's very strong-minded because of the Al-Anon that she went to, too, yes.
Definitely. It'd be interesting to talk to them a little bit about what it's like to live with an alcoholic and what it's like to go through everything that they did go through.
Yes. Well, you know what they said, what General Curtis LeMay said to me. General Curtis LeMay said when he picked me and 249 other men to travel around the world with him as his special security in Strategic Air Command, he was the first general that ever ran any branch of the service and never graduated from West Point. And he was a tough man, and he was a street language. And he said to me, "You seem to have had military experience." And I told him about my lifestyle in the streets before I enlisted in the United States Air Force. He said, "Oh, I see. Okay, so you see, there's a military type code with me in my family tradition to obey orders. We're an ununiformed army. Let me put it that way, and we're a government within ourselves. But now I drifted away from that when I found sobriety. That's why I took the law into my own hands when I defended my daughter's honor. My children see me as a military man at home because I didn't lose in my trained mind my way of bringing forth to them the teachings that I had still comes out when it comes to family tradition. Today I feel as though too many kids are losing family tradition, and that's why they're going wild in the streets. And there's no more that, not as much family tradition as it used to be, you know. And that's why my children, they're able to live with me because I told them that now they have to drift off and call the authorities when someone harms them, and then come to me after that, I said. But call the authorities first.
I want to go back to your boxing days, and you were a boxer in the United States Air Force.
Yes.
And you said you boxed for 10 years. Tell us a little bit about what that was like, and you did active duty over in Japan, and that's where you are?
Yeah, well, I started out at the Catholic Youth Organization when I was 15 years old, and my father had me in a gym with his fighters, and I used to train and watch them, and I used to spar with them, and as I grew older, I got into the Golden Gloves, and from the Golden Gloves, I won three fights without fighting because they call that BYE. In other words, if your opponent doesn't show up, you win in the Golden Gloves. And they didn't show up because I was Jimmy Knapp's son and I had top trainers with me, and their trainers said, "Don't fight that guy. He's a sleeper. He'll knock you out." Well, anyway, when I finally fought a guy, it was a Jewish guy, and the guy cut me up, and the referee stopped the fight. Well, that was in the Golden Gloves. And then I went on into the Air Force, and I represented the United States Air Force in the tournaments leading up into the Olympics. However, what happened was my mother was sick with cancer, And after doing 2 years in the Air Force, I had two more years to go. My father got a hold of a congressman to get me out on an emergency leave, and it interrupted my boxing career in the United States Air Force, because in those days, to be on the United States boxing team in the Olympics, you had to be on active duty in any branch of the service. Today, you don't. But you had to be in the military, any branch of the service, to be on the American boxing team representing America in the Olympics. Well, now, that was in those days. So now when I got honorably discharged under hardship conditions to help stay with my mother. Now, my father's fixed everything up, but it's in the book, that he wasn't there to take care of us. But he did that to himself to get me home because my mother wanted me home. And, of course, I told my mother when I got home, Ma, I can't do anything for you, you know. And Dad made himself look bad with the government and with the public that he's like a deserter, and he's not. Why did he do that? She said, because he'll do anything for you like you would do anything for your children when you get married. And my mother was so right, you know. That boxing career I had when I became Tony Rio and changed my name and helped me make a living, because I was able to box and fight to make a living when I was Tony Rio. So, however, my bonds, they called me Tony Rio the Bondstormer on Route 66. I traveled on Route 66 because I was taught always follow your nose. So that I took from Chicago all the way to L.A., Route 66. I never got to L.A. in time. I got, because of the problems I had in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that was on my way to L.A., but I never got to L.A., and I stayed in Albuquerque, yes, for three years, in a town called Tucumcari, New Mexico, and Santa Rosa, New Mexico. I stayed there for 3 years or 2 months when I was hiding out on a lamb, yes, and boxing for the carnivals. And that was how my boxing career was. I was a sparring partner. I made a living as a sparring partner, too, for Bob Foster, who was from Albuquerque, and I boxed with him and trained with him, getting him ready for his title fights. He was the light heavyweight champ of the world later on.
But what you know, advice would you give you know, these youngsters out here and some of these elders as well that's still out here drinking and drugging? You know, what advice would you give them?
Well, the advice I would give is this. They have to walk away from the group of gang guys. Now, take the gang guys. It's hard when they're young. All right, to walk away from that group, because then you're called a chicken, or you're not part of the clique, and you're not respected. So, but you got to stay away from the gangs and see if you can drift away. It's hard to say that, well, stay home in a room and read a book. But I find this, that you, and I know of guys, and during my time when I was growing up, I was part of a gang too. Yes, it was called the Apaches in Brooklyn, in Queens, in Brooklyn. Well, anyway, my father didn't know about it, but when he found out about it, he pulled me by the hair and said, you don't belong to no punk gang like that. Well, anyway, the thing is to try and go to the gym. I would have to say this. Go to the gym. Work out. Go to any gym. Work out. And occupy your mind that way, because those guys in the gangs that try to get you might not want to bother you because they know you can defend yourself. And remember, one man in a gang is a weakling, but when he has three or four other guys around him, he becomes all of a sudden a tough guy. My advice is, anytime there's a gang that wants you, get their leader and spar off with him and beat the hell out of him and go home. And they won't bother you no more when you beat their leader. You'll have to use your hands, I'm sorry to say. I don't know any other way that a kid today, a teenager, young teenager, could avoid being recruited at the gang without walking and saying, fight me now. Even if you can't fight, take a beat in front of them and walk away. They'll never bother you again because they say you're screwball. You just want to, you're crazy or something, they'll say, you know. How could you want to fight our leader or something, you know? But that would be the advice. Take the beating when you're young, but don't get yourself killed either, I mean. But that's the only way I can advise you. And there's no other way you can avoid that, but the way I'm saying, I believe that if you don't show physical force somehow, some way, because you're not going to be able to preach to them, you're not going to be able to talk to them, they're going to laugh at you and beat the hell out of you.
Right.
So I'm sorry to say that's the only way I know, unless you could think of another way, Rob.
Right. Well, you know, the way, like you just put it, you know, that's the only way, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, they have to get educated as well, you know what I'm saying? And
right.
We are very honored that you are not only spreading your sobriety, but you're educating people about what's happening as well, opening their mind up to what's real and not what's fiction, you know? So definitely we got to give you fix up on that, Mr. Knapp.
You got to stay in the gymnasium, show you could have self-defense, is strong for your mind, and do your schooling too. And you'll see, and they'll see how fast they'll get respect from the gang guys and say, hey, leave him alone, the guy can fight or something. But you can't be, it's a shame to say that, you just can't be a weakling. You got to be strong.
Oh, no. You get ran over foot trying to be a weak guy, you know?
Yeah, otherwise they have you. But that's where it starts. That's the root. That's the seed. When you join a gang, you're finished. And it's going to be hard to get away from it. It's going to be hard. Now, I know of there are rap singers, I know of football players, I know of baseball players, and I know of fighters, too, that make good money today, and because they were part of a gang when they were growing up, that they actually still send some money to those guys. That they don't get harmed, or their family doesn't get harmed. It's a shakedown, yeah. But these type of guys I'm talking about, if you gotta break away from the gang by not joining the gang. And when you become successful in life, you're not bothered later on when those gang members are still alive and a little older. They'll think you owe them, you know. They'll shake you down. It's not unusual that we have a lot of football players that they share some of their money with their old friends from the gang days, yeah. Not all their money, just enough to keep them quiet, you know. And it goes on and on and on, on and on and on.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Ring 8 Veterans Boxing Association? I believe your father started that years
ago.
Yes,
in April of 1954. And he was one of the founders, yes. And I stay with it. And I see, I'm there with the professional fighters today that belong to Ring 8. And I try to talk them out of quitting sooner. If they didn't become a champ after 20 fights or so, I say, get out of it. Go get a job. Because too many are getting hurt today because of the fact that they're not in great shape. It's not like it used to be, you know. And you hear of a fighter with 15 fights fighting for the title. Well, therefore, I say that's not right. That's why I'm against that. That's not right. You have to have more fights for your body to get hardened up to be able to take the blows before you go into a 12-round title fight. No, they're rushing them because of TV time and the TV promoters because of the money. Now, they got more champs in each division than they ever did during my time. Now, you got about 15 middleweight champs. Isn't that ridiculous? I mean, that's what they do for TV time. TV says, oh, there's a title fight tonight. The one kid had 15 fights, the other kid had 20 fights. A title fight. It's ridiculous to fool the public for the money. And now the weigh-in is very bad. They have the weigh-in in 3 days before the fight. Now, if the guy is 130 pounds and he's supposed to fight under 130 pounds, he's going to fight under 160 pounds because he eats a lot and gains 30 pounds of water and carbohydrates in 3 days. We used to take the weigh-in the afternoon of the fight.
Right.
This way we had to stay in shape that way. But TV has changed everything around TV money, that is, TV money. But the kids, they make their money. But today you don't know who the champ is. This guy's a champ. This guy's a champ. This guy, everybody's a champ. And
right.
That ruins the game.
And they're making big money at it. So it's, you know, it's intriguing to young kids who think that, you know, or that want to be a champion.
Correct. Correct. It is intriguing to them. And now they can walk away when they retire or get out of it. I was a champ. And it's true, they were a champ. But then during their time, let's say in 2012, he retires and he was a middleweight champ. And then years later, all of a sudden they talk about this champ, and there was about 15 middleweight champs the same year. That's what's going to be confusing. That's what's going to be confusing,
yeah. We need to instill in the kids and the youth today that you can be a champion no matter what you do, as long as you do your best at it.
Exactly.
That's true. No. You don't have to be a champ. And the object is to put up a good fight, defend yourself, and to be a champ, it leads you into becoming a champ.
But no doubt.
If they had good trainers, what today I noticed, most of the trainers today are the fathers or the uncles, and they didn't have much experience themselves. That your experienced trainers today, we don't have them anymore. We really don't have them, and this kid could get hurt in the gym before he comes into the arena, like if he's training for a boxing match, and he's in the gym. He could get hurt in that gym because the trainers don't have experience enough to know how to wrap their hands in the gym, what to put them in for sparring and when not to put them on the heavy bag or the speed bag, and then have them do a lot of road work, what they call jogging. I call it road work. That means running in the morning. Run every morning, 2-3 miles every morning. And the day you're sparring, don't run. Go to the gym and box, because you don't run when you're sparring that day. You spar the next day. You run the day that you're not sparring. When you're sparring, it takes a lot out of you. If you're sparring in a good session, like not bluffing it, you know, really sparring, I mean, throwing blows. So you have to know how to rest your body to take the blows. If you run in the daytime and you're going to go to the gym in the afternoon to spar 3 rounds, your body is exhausted. You have to adjust your road work, mixing it with your sparring sessions as well. You know, try not to run the same day you're sparring. You could jump rope in the gym, you know.
Yeah.
And we just want to say, Mr. Knapp, we've been definitely having a great time, and we definitely loving the message that you're bringing, and we would like for you to get the viewers your website again to go get that book tonight, My Father, My Don. You know, give it out to them, Mr. Knapp.
All right. It's My Father, My Don. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and you can get it in any retail store. Just ask the clerk for their catalog and order from the catalog. That usually these retail stores, now the bookstores, are not storing on their shelves because of the internet where people are buying them from. But to get an autographed copy of My Father, My Don, you definitely have to go to my website. That's the only place you get an autographed copy, unless you meet me personally. The autographed copy is on www.myfathermydon.com.
And
you'll
and
see pictures
website.
Of
you'll
my family. You'll see pictures of my family and everything. Yeah, and then you'll send me, it'll direct you how to get to me by mail, and I'll mail you an autographed copy of my book and a picture of me with a bookmark with a little bio of me. So that's how I could advise you to get an autographed copy. If you don't want an autographed copy, you just want the book. Now, I'm on ebook and I'm on Kindle as well. So if you wanted it in less than 5 minutes, just go on the internet, My Father, My Don, go to ebook, or go to Kindle on Amazon.com, and you'll have it in a couple of minutes.
Your you want to know more about Mr. Jimmy Knapp and his life, as well as Tony's life growing up in the mob. Very interesting reading, very interesting stories, and you know, Tony keeps it real. So I, you know, go out and get the book. It's an awesome book. We just, again, one more time, Tony, want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing part of your life and your story of sobriety, and we definitely want to get that, you know, that the information out to people, you know, that, you know, to go through the recovery steps. You know, life is so much better when you're able to remember it and do the right things. A lot of people out here get that alcohol on them and get that liquid courage and make some stupid mistakes and sometimes hurt a lot of people, you know, as they're going along. So, you know, we definitely want to encourage everyone to try to stay away from the alcohol and, you know, not let that rule your life and take over your life. Do you have any last words on that, Tony?
Oh, yes. I would like to to the youngsters I direct this. Please try and before you could go into sobriety, even if you're not an alcoholic, and the sobriety will give you enough strength. And there's a prayer that we say at the end of every session, and goes like this: God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Good luck to everybody out there. And stay away from those street gangs, please. The best.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Okay.
All right. That sounds like a winner, you know, and pay close attention to the message tonight. And once again, we just want to thank Mr. Knapp for his time. And it's an honor having him here at the show. And we wish you much success with the message and with the book.
Thank you about the message. Yes, that's more important than anything else. Yeah, and of course, for the kids that can't get out of the street gangs, they should read a book called The Streets Don't Love You Back by Robert Boyd. And that might help them because you went through it, my friend. You lived through it more so than I ever did. Wow. You got out of there alive.
I appreciate it, Mr. Knapp. God was good. You know, you brought me a long way. And I just feel very honored just for you to even speak that, you know, Mr. Knapp.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a pleasure for me tonight.
Yeah. You, and The Streets Don't Love You Back, the book you did, that you authored, Robert. Let me tell you, I've been reading it, and it's just right for teenagers because of the fact that you'll see pictures on every page almost. And I remember I used to like to read comic books. And
right.
It got my interest. A picture is worth 1,000 words. It's very true. I like this book, The Streets Don't Love You Back. Yes. And, of course, the message it brings to the teenagers is very important. Yes.
Thank you so much, Mr. Knapp.
Okay, then, buddy. All right, buddy. We'll stay in touch. Right? Okay.
All right, Mr. Knapp. You have a good day, good night, and I always remember, people, the streets don't love you back.
Okay, my friend. Take care of yourself, you and Lucinda.
Thank you very much.
As we say in Italian, Giandana, that means 100 more years of happiness.
Hey, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Tony. Have a wonderful night.
All right, Lucinda. Good night, though.
Good night.